Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Lee Traynor, Ashmi Geddes on behalf of Appellants, the Orchard Enterprises. Your Honors, with me at counsel table is my colleague, Tony Ann Pladia, as well as Ken Thaler of S&R Denton in Washington, D.C. With the Court's permission, Mr. Thaler will present the argument.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you.
When I start the clock, you'll see a green light, and when it switches to yellow, that's the 5 minutes you've reserved. You can continue talking, but you will be using up the time you've reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we're here today, and the Orchard has appealed because the Chancellor below applied this Court's ruling in Cavalier Oil versus Harnett in a way that created, in our case, a wholly artificial valuation and departed from the plain language of 8 Delaware Code 262. And the Chancellor did this by deciding that he could not consider, as a matter of the statute and as a matter of law, a $25 million change of control preference that was held by the preferred stockholders and that was indisputably an obligation of the company to the preferred stockholders that indisputably arose from $25 million in cash that was invested by the preferred stockholders in the company and that was indisputably the most important factor impacting the value of the common shares in the market and otherwise prior to the merger at issue. Your Honor, we would submit...
Are you saying that we have to regard the preference as a debt?
Your Honor, I would say that whether it's regarded as a debt, as a liability, it is certainly an obligation.
Well, if it's a debt, it's a fixed liability, and it's deducted from the, it's something that has to be paid off, and that has to be assumed in determining the value of the equity, the fair value of the company, and then the fair value of the equity itself. If it isn't debt, then it is some sort of, some form of equity, in which case the question becomes whether it's an obligation that has to be treated as debt. It matters. And the question is, what do we have here?
Your Honor, I would submit that we have an obligation that should be treated as debt. However,
the reason
is because this is an obligation that will have to be repaid by the company to the preferred stockholders
but
before.
Only if and when, correct? And was there an if and when on the date of the merger?
There was not a when on the date of the merger, Your Honor.
So
we would say there
what's
was.
What's left of your case?
What's left of the case, Your Honor, is we've got the economic reality of the company. We've got the economic reality in a young, early-stage company financed by private venture equity that and valued by the market as the economic reality.
Well, let me stop you there. Is your argument the one based on a rule of law? And if so, what is it? Or is it based on some flexible equitable consideration?
It's based on the rule of law, Your Honor, and it's based on Section 262H, where it says, in determining fair value, the court shall take into account all relevant factors. And that includes, as the Weinberger Court held, the market value of the shares.
But doesn't that go on to say, in all relevant factors known and susceptible of proof on the day of the merger?
And, Your Honor, we would submit not only is the liquidation preference known and susceptible of proof, but that it was proof. That it was.
But weren't there conditions or what I'll call triggering events?
Yes, Your Honor, but we would submit that triggering events are not required. What we're talking about here is the impact day-to-day on a going concern, on the going concern of the Orchard, of this liquidation preference.
Well,
not
but
when
that
it
goes
triggers.
Back to Justice Jacobs' question, though, and there's if we have a debt that you're going to have to pay, and we know when the debt's due, you factor that into the valuation. But if you have something that's not a debt with a date certain, and you simply have something that may happen if conditions are met, and none of those conditions are operative now, why isn't that a legitimate distinction?
Because, Your Honor, I would answer twofold to that. The primary reason why it isn't, in our view, is that the trigger is not speculative, or the obligation is not speculative, because the obligation exists throughout this period in time. It's not speculative precisely because it hasn't triggered. And that obligation and the evidence that we put on at trial that was undisputed showed that that obligation was the primary determinant of the market's valuation of this company. It was the primary impediment to selling the company. There was an extensive effort to sell the company, followed by a go shop. There were no plausible offers. The one offer that came in took into account the 25.
Those are all equitable factors, but you told us, or you told me, that you're relying on a rule of law, and the rule of law is the section of the appraisal statute that requires the court to take into account all relevant factors.
That's correct.
The problem is the statute doesn't tell the court how precisely it's supposed to take those factors into account. What you're really asking is to take this factor into account as if it were a fixed obligation at the date of the merger, yet as a factual matter it wasn't.
As a factual matter, Your Honor, it was an obligation that did operate as a fixed obligation. It's an obligation the preferreds were going to get their $25 million first, no matter what. There was no way that the company could, either through liquidation, through a change in control, through a sale to another party, could get out from under that obligation, Your Honor. The statute says...
But don't you agree, or do you agree, that in an appraisal proceeding, which this is, that all of these obligations, such as they may be, have to be ascertainable and that have to exist as of the date of the merger if they're going to be taken into account in the way you want them to be taken into account, which is to be treated as a fixed debt?
We absolutely agree that the obligations have to be ascertainable. This is ascertainable. It's a fixed amount. It's $24.99 million. If we were to use the language of Shifton, for example, we have a specific...
Well, it's a fixed amount, but it's not a fixed amount that is due and owing on the date of the merger.
Well, it's...
That's a reality, isn't it?
It's a fixed amount that is owing on the date of the merger, Your Honor.
Owing?
It is a fixed amount. It's an obligation that the company has on the date of the merger.
It's a contingent obligation, isn't it?
Yes, but it's an obligation that in the facts of this case and under the circumstances of this company and with this certificate of designations will be paid one way or another at some point.
Yeah, and in the future if there is a triggering event.
Right, but the common stockholders...
So the question I have, and perhaps we have, is what rule of law, if we were to write an opinion reversing the Vice Chancellor, how would you articulate the rule of law that should go into our opinion?
I would articulate the rule of law in the same terms that the Weinberger Court articulated it.
That who?
The Weinberger, UOP versus Weinberger, this court in that case. I would articulate that where you have a specific contractual right that is ascertainable in amount, that bears on, among other things, the market value of the shares. That is a relevant factor that under the statute must be considered.
If it bears on the market value of the shares, what does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, maybe I can try better articulation. The Weinberger Court said market value must be considered. The court below did not consider the market value of the shares. The court below, the market value of the shares here is determined. It's burdened by, it's impacted by this liquidation preference. The market at every level, and the testimony was undisputed, took into account the liquidation preference. That's how the financial community valued the company. It's how the investment community valued the company. It was something that any reasonable investor or market participant would have taken into account. But by looking for a trigger, which the Chancery Court did, one comes to an artificial result here. One comes to a company that has a $25 million obligation, whether equity or not, to its preferred stockholders. That is the dominant factor for the company. It will have to be paid. It is the dominant factor in the market. And the court says, I just can't look at that under the statute or under the case law. That's too speculative because it doesn't trigger. But the obligation is not speculative, Your Honor. The obligation is there throughout. It's that obligation that is the economic reality and the market reality for this company. And if under 262H and Weinberger, Cavalier Oil, and the other cases, what we're trying to look at is all relevant factors in considering the company. How do we ignore that? How do we come out to what is an artificial result here, that there is no way the common...
When you say artificial result, I'm not sure what would be a natural result, because it appears that your argument, were we to accept it, would conflate or abolish the distinction between debt and equity.
I don't believe that's what we're doing here, Your Honor. We have an obligation that is a relevant economic factor for valuing the stock of this company. It was relevant for the market to value it, and we're saying that has to be considered. It has to be given some weight, and here it was given no weight. And the reason, Your Honor, I say that the result is artificial is the common shares were trading at $1.66 before this particular merger was announced, $1.50 before prior one. They'd never traded above $2 in the preceding year period. The reason for that was the $25 million liquidation preference.
Well, I asked you earlier if you were relying on a rule of law, and you said yes and cited one to me. Let me ask you a different question. Is there anything that you can point us to in the finance literature that would justify this kind of treatment of a preference that has not been triggered on the relevant date with the result that we would have to monetize the entire preference?
Your Honor, we pointed to some authority in our opening brief at pages 29 to 31 on this. We would point to the certified American Institute of Certified Public Accountants practice guides for small companies that says that in a startup where you've got venture providing, that it is considered to be a debt-like obligation. We pointed to Hitchner on financial valuation, which talks about the preference being an economic right that is enjoyed by the preferred stockholders. We pointed out the SEC regulations that require on the financial statements filed with the SEC and available to the public that on the left side shown on the face of the financial, not on a footnote, is the full amount of the liquidation preference, and that is shown for the fact, as Mr. Fesnik testified at trial, that it is absolutely important to the common stockholder. You've got a fact here, Your Honor. You've got a fact of this preference. That is what everybody is looking at when they value the company. And whether we call it debt or whether we call it equity, in this circumstance where you have a liquidation preference, and we cited a survey that in 199 out of 200 venture-financed early-stage companies, there was such a liquidation preference. The
preference that becomes due on liquidation.
It becomes due on a change of control as well, Your Honor, in this circumstance. But in a company such as this, where there's more than enough money to pay the preference, it will be paid one way or another, and the testimony was undisputed at that level. Even the bidder B offer talked about...
It really wasn't a change of control, because control already was there. In the buyer, and it wasn't a liquidation. So I'm not sure where your argument leads us to.
Even this transaction, Your Honor, would have been barred by the certificate of designations. They had to be amended. The preferred stockholders had to agree to amend it just to permit this transaction in the first place.
Well, why wasn't the charter amended to permit precisely the result that you're arguing for here?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I can speak to why that precise change was not made.
Because there would be a separate class vote?
Well, there was a separate class vote of the preferreds to permit the amendment that permitted this transaction.
The controller, of course, was the preferred shareholder, but owned less than a majority of the common stock. That is, the common stock was out there. The majority was out there in the hands of the public, as I understand it. So on a separate class vote, there was a real risk that the common would reject that amendment, and isn't it more likely than not that in order to let this go through, this middle ground was adopted?
That was...
It did not expressly allow what it is your client is trying to do here.
I do not believe that's why the what you call the middle ground was adopted, because there was a majority of the minority provision in the merger, and there was an overwhelming majority of the common stockholders who voted for the merger.
You're talking about the merger, but
yes.
I'm talking about the amendment.
Well, Your Honor.
The amendment that changed the preferences to allow this transaction to take place at all.
The price that was established by the merger, the 205, the recommendation of the special committee, the recommendation of the special committee's advisors, was based on accounting for the $25 million liquidation preference to get to the 205 offer, Your Honor.
You're into the time that you've reserved. Would you like to keep that time?
I would like to keep the time unless the court has another question for me at
Very well.
This time.
Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The preferred stock at issue here is not debt. It's a preferred stock instrument created by a certificate of designation. It has some unusual provisions in it that make it quite weak, actually. But the provisions we're talking about now are it is entitled to a preference payment of $25 million if and when one of three things happens: a liquidation of the company, a sale of all the assets of the company, followed by a liquidation as part of the same transaction, or a sale of the entire company to an unaffiliated third party. And so this is an appraisal case. Each expert put in a discounted cash flow valuation. The assumption in those discounted cash flow valuations, which the Chancellor accepted, was that this company is going to operate as a going concern into perpetuity. Therefore, under the valuation of the equity in this case, by definition, none of the triggering events that would lead to a payment of $25 million will ever occur.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Opposing counsel said, in addition to the arguments about the liquidation preference, just directly, also suggested that that preference has been holding down the market price of the stock, and that market value is one component of the analysis that should be undertaken in an appraisal, and that the trial court did not consider market value at all. Is that correct?
Well, I don't believe it was ever argued. I mean, their expert came in and said the preferred stock should be allocated a $25 million value because the preference was triggered in the merger. It was simply wrong. That was a wrong argument.
So you're saying that the comment that was made here earlier, unless I misunderstood what was said, that was not an argument that was presented to the trial court?
I don't believe so. But even if it was, Your Honor, this was a thinly traded security. There were no analysts following it. There was no argument that the real argument here by any expert that the market value should have been considered. But even if it should have been, it has no application here. In the appraisal case, the assumption is everyone was submitting a discounted cash flow valuation. The assumption is the company will operate as a going concern into perpetuity. The liquidation preference will never be paid. But even if you ignore that, if you have a security that's entitled to a possible contingent payment of $25 million, because that's what we're talking about here, determining what the preferred stock is worth.
Right, and I'm trying to shift away from that for a moment. Because as I understand the argument that was made here, in addition to hitting the issue directly in terms of whether that should have been included or should not have been included in the valuation, the other statement that was made by opposing counsel was that the market value of the stock was depressed because of this liquidation preference and that the court didn't even consider market value, which is one element of value that is traditionally, it may not be given a lot of weight, but it's traditionally part of the overall analysis in an appraisal. So is it correct that there was an argument made about that and or that the trial court said, I'm not going to consider market value? What? Tell me about it.
I don't believe it was fairly presented. I don't believe it's addressed in the opinion because it was never fairly presented. But, and I don't think, I think it's waived anyway. This is a challenge, a narrow challenge to pages 12 through 18 of the opinion. The court's ruling, and they've made this clear in their brief, as to what the value of the preferred stock is. What the value of the, whether the court should have used a different analysis to come up with a total equity value other than a discounted cash flow valuation, like by considering some a comparable company valuation, which there was some effort to argue for, or market price, is not in the case anymore. They're only arguing that the ruling, finding that the value of the preferred stock is its as converted basis, was wrong.
Well, there are really two issues. One is whether $25 million should be deducted from the fair value of the company, regardless of how fair value is determined. That's the issue before us now. And the second issue is, what is fair value and how should it be determined? On the latter issue, it may be the case that market price is a relevant factor, but that would depend on the type, on the methodology for valuations being used. Was there any methodology that was argued before the Vice Chancellor other than discounted cash flow?
I don't remember any. There was, in the defendant's report, there was an attempt, I believe, to have a little bit of a comparable company valuation. And it was determined that there were no comparable companies.
But whatever, to the extent market value might be a relevant factor, it would go toward the issue of fair value or, you know, going concern value as of the date of the merger, as distinguished from the question of whether, whatever that value may be, $25 million should be taken off the top and allocated to the controller.
Exactly. And, Your Honor, that second issue has been waived. It's expressly waived in the brief. They're only arguing, I mean, they made this clear, we're only arguing his ruling on the value of the preferred stock. And the value of the preferred stock, if you have an instrument that entitles you to $25 million at some point in the future, if certain things happen, obviously you can't say it's worth $25 million today. I mean, the question is, when will it be paid? And is there any likelihood it'll be paid? Here, there was no proof ever submitted. It was an argument about, you know, factual evidence of when it will be paid. In fact, and I even heard this statement from my opposing counsel that the preferred would get $25 million no matter what. And I put that in quotes. I think I got it correct. That is simply untrue. Under the valuation methodology they submitted, it won't be paid if the company continues to operate as a going concern.
But,
which is the assumption in the case.
Well, all right. But the controller now owns 100% of the company.
Correct.
And the controller can sell that company or his stock to a third party, an unrelated third party, and then the preferred would get the $25 million. So, there is a an economically rational scenario in the future under which that might occur, although it hasn't happened yet.
But in an appraisal case, the statute requires to assume that the merger didn't occur and determine the fair value of the company if it had continued to operate as a going concern into perpetuity instead of engaging in the merger transaction.
Okay, well, you're talking about the appraisal theory, and I'm just talking about economic reality.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think the economic reality is there was a series of preferred stock. It's a contractual instrument. You can determine its value. You must determine its value by looking at its terms. And here, its terms entitled it. And There's multiple references to speculative, and this isn't speculative. I think there's some confusion about what we're talking about as speculative. The terms are there in the instrument. It says when it's entitled to certain payments.
So your position is that the $25 million can be lopped off the top only if the triggers, and one of the triggers that would make that an enforceable obligation, that is an enforceable obligation at the date of the merger, had occurred, and it didn't.
Or even if there was some proof that it was be expected to occur. I mean, there was another case that was Shifton, which was a case decided 6 months before this by the chancellor that was, as he said, a nice contrast to this. There, the preferred stock had an actual date on which it was entitled to a payment 6 months after the merger, so the court could say, well, we can value that preferred stock. We can that payment's going to happen.
That was like a promissory note.
And that was more like a debt. That payment that was due, you can discount that back to present value and arrive at a value for the security. Here, there was no evidence as to when or if the preference would ever be paid. In effect, it was speculative. And I submit, it actually goes further than that. It's not just speculative. It's never going to happen under the facts that are no longer at issue with this case. Under the methodology here, the value of the equity is determined by assuming the company operates into perpetuity. There's not going to be a liquidation. And so the $25 million is not relevant. The value of the preferred...
It's not legally relevant, right?
I'm sorry?
It's not legally relevant.
It's not. I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor, exactly. It's not legally relevant because the value of this security is under the assumptions that are applicable in the case can only be, if you look at its provisions, it's as converted value. The other preference that this preferred security had was a convertibility feature into common stock. Unusually, it didn't have a special dividend right. It only had the right to share in the common dividends on an as-converted basis. And its conversion feature was, it was more than one for one, so the preferred stock actually amounted to a significant component of the common equity, if you look at it from its conversion feature. But that's how the court determined it was appropriate to value it. I do want to say something about the standard of review, if I could. I don't think this is a legal issue. I think this is an abuse of discretion standard of review. The decision was essentially a factual finding that if and when the preferred payment would be made was speculative. And so, based on that, there's no evidence in the record to show that there was an abuse of discretion in that factual finding. I do want to say, Your Honor, that I was trying to figure out how to best make my argument today, and I know the court's read the chancellor's opinion, but we're really talking about a sort of separate, standalone component of the opinion that's on pages 12 to 18, and I find it difficult to come up with a way to articulate why the appellant's argument is wrong that's different from how he articulated it, because I think it's a very, very clear reasoning, goes through the certificate of designation, goes through the relevant cases, and concludes that in this appraisal case, under settled appraisal law, this possible obligation is not something that can be considered added into the valuation in this case.
Or deducted from.
And that's what I'm my wording isn't perfect, but that's right, deducted from. Unless the court has any other questions, I have nothing further. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, if I may respond to my fellow counsel's assertion that market value was not raised. fellow counsel concedes that what we're appealing from is pages 12 to 18 of the Chancellor's decision. At page 17, the Chancellor acknowledged that Orchard's premise may be grounded in market realities. There was extensive testimony about this. The market value of the shares fully accounted for the $25 million preference right. You'll find that at, among many other places, Appendix 797, 779.
What he had in mind, I gather, is that whenever you have a public company with a controller, the fact that there is an overhang of control will could have some depressing effect on the market price.
That is correct, Your Honor.
The question, though, is whether that fact has any legal relevance at all to the issue that's before us.
Your Honor, how could that fact not have legal relevance?
Well, it could not because it wasn't a fact that the statute permits the court to take into account since it was not an operative, that is a fact that could properly be taken into account on the day of the merger since it wasn't a debt.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that while some may not consider it to be a debt, we've cited some authority that other analysts and experts consider it to be debt-like, the fact is it was an important, arguably the most important, indisputably in the evidence at trial, the most important
factor waiving.
Well,
is your legal argument that
waiving,
it should be treated like a debt? Is that the legal argument?
Well, in these circumstances, it certainly could be treated like a debt, but the legal argument at base is all relevant factors must be considered under 262H. That includes, as Weinberger says, all factors including
right,
market value.
Based on your analysis, that doesn't get you to $25 million. Let me explain that. Your argument is that the fact that there's a controller will cause the market price to be less than what it would be if there wasn't a controller. We don't know to what extent the market was depressed. Maybe by 10%. That may be $1 a share. It may be $2 or $3 a share. But how do you get to $25 million from
that? We're not arguing here, Your Honor, that the market price was depressed because there was a controller. We're arguing that the market assessed and valued, and we put on substantial evidence, and it is cited in our brief, in the fact section of the opening brief, that we were making these arguments. We put on substantial evidence that the market valued that obligation as $25 million. Bidder B, everyone else in the market, everyone purchasing shares, valued it at $25 million. Weinberger says market value is something that must be considered. Rapid American says, well, you don't want to overvalue it, but you got to be considering it. And the result...
The market undervalues is undervalued because of the overhang of control by one penny, just to take a hypothetical. That automatically generates $25 million for your client to be allocated from the merger process.
The error here, Your Honor, is that it wasn't considered at all. Whether it's automatically $25 million, whether it's one penny, the Chancellor did not consider the effect of the liquidation preference. He felt he could not.
There's a reason he didn't consider it. And what we're asking you is, what's wrong with his reason?
Well, and Your Honor, we would submit that what's wrong with the reason is that that the reason fails to take into account the biggest obligation of the company, the biggest economic reality of the company, the market, what caused the market value of the company to be set where it was. The result in this case, Your Honor, is there's a $25 million obligation that carries forward that the common stockholders never could have gotten out from under, that was indisputable, extensive testimony about that, and now they're able, through the artifice of the appraisal proceeding, to get out from under that $25 million obligation, and the company, meanwhile, will be required to pay it twice. The company still has the obligation going forward. It will be taken at some point. In the meantime, it's got to pay the $25 million to the common.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments.
Thank you.
The court will take this matter under advisement.